This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Monocle 24 on the 31st of January 2012. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, with a crisp, crunch and a bit of a wobble, we're taking a look at the curious crossover between design and food. And we don't mean tiny little piles of complex concoctions, nice to look at but a nightmare to eat. No, we're looking at how design can complement, enhance and improve the art of cooking and eating. Fun with food. Coming up in the show, we find out if too many cooks do spoil the broth and sit down with four of our favourite chefs to hear about their dream kitchen and utensil designs.
Everything look good, which is really important when you're cooking. For me, every process is important. So using a nice pan, stirring it with a spoon that's worn down and you love. All of those things and serving it on something beautiful is really important.
That was Chef Bill Granger talking to Taya Erdal. We drop in on the studio kitchen of London's Bompas and Parr to hear how they laid their foundations in architecture with jelly.
You know, once upon a time, in the Regency period, jelly was a very, very fine, exalted dessert, and we've been trying to restore it up onto its, put it back on its pedestal. It's a dessert that delights. It's you know, really quite magical.
And we tour the stands of the recent Paris de Chef event hosted by Alain Ducasse, that teams designers and chefs for a spot of culinary wizardry.
Who is the person behind the guy that did cook this idea, the concept? So he's got his own personality. We need to understand. We need to discuss with him. We need to exchange.
All that plus some words of wisdom from Martin Brudnitsky about how a well-designed environment enhances a dining experience. More shenanigans with three more chefs in San Francisco, London and Beirut. And my favourite song about chewing gum. That's all to come in the next hour on Section D. Stay tuned. Welcome one and all to Section D. Now, we all know a chef is only as good as his or her tools. We also know that every chef has their favourite tools, which they cherish and care for like children. Keen to hear a little more about this particular relationship, we dropped in on four wonderful chefs from four different regions to hear about their kitchen design fantasies. Number one on our list, Australia's pin-up, Bill Granger.
It's so hard for me to think of my favourite kitchenware store. I mean, my two favourite cities are London and Tokyo, for shopping in general and for my favourite kitchen shops. In London, it has to be David Mellor in Sloane Square, which has been there a long time. And what I love about it is that it's got a very modernist, minimalist attitude to it. Where a lot of kitchen stores, everything's, you know, jammed in and it can sort of be a lot more country and earthy. David Mellor's got a really sleek urban feel about it. And I love that. When I first moved to London, I didn't have any kitchenware. So I started again. So I went there and was really careful about what I got because you can tend to get a lot of extra junk in your kitchen. And, you know, you're rifling through full drawers full of utensils you never use. And I found there I could get the perfect anything. I got three pots. I got, you know, two good wooden spoons, a few serving dishes, one good teapot, some simple white plates. And everything looked good, which is really important when you're cooking. For me, every process is important. So using a nice pan, stirring it with a spoon that's worn down and you love, all of those things and serving it on something beautiful is really important. And in Tokyo, there's two things I love. There's Kabashi Street, which is the opposite to David Mellor. It is the restaurant supply street. So you get these amazing shops selling all restaurant utensils. So the plastic food, but also, you know, great bamboo mats, dishes, really cheap, well-priced dishes that look incredibly beautiful. That's wonderful. But also there's another little shop in Tokyo where I'm obsessed every time I go. It's called J Period, and it's in Omotesando Hills. It's down in the basement. It's really reasonably priced for what it is, and you can get the most beautiful Japanese ceramics. And for me, the most important thing about food is the presentation when you're putting it on a great bowl. And they're well priced and not precious enough that you can put them in the dishwasher, which seems very prosaic, which is very important for me. I don't want to be careful about the things I'm using. And yeah, they're my favourite places. when you're building a kitchen and you're building up a base of things you're cooking with, you're buying things for life. If you buy good quality things, they're for life. They don't really wear out. I mean, if you think of professional kitchens, the work the equipment get is amazing. And I've got, you know, stainless steel bowls at my house in Sydney that I've had for 20 years and they're sort of a bit beaten around and they get better and better and better. And so going into a kitchenware store, it's, you know, it's adding things to your home. It's building up memories around, you know, a hearty, wholesome kitchen is great. I really like, you know, what those things do. So when I go to a kitchenware store, I step into an imaginary world when I have time to bake all day, when I've got, you know, a big range where I'm sort of, you know, got stews bubbling away, I'm baking cakes. And that's what I love about it. It's almost, it's a bit of fantasy mixed with the reality of, you know, my more prosaic life of getting food on the table very quickly. Kitchenwares, it's almost like you can get quite obsessed of different, I mean, it's almost different brands as well. You get obsessed by cult pieces. And, you know, kitchenware is an essential. We all have to use it. We all need to cook. Even if it's most basic, you know, thing. We need a knife to cut things, we need a chopping board, we need some plates to eat off. Even if you don't cook, you at least have those sort of basic things, a frying pan. And you can go from that level to an absolute essential. I've been into friends' houses who don't cook at all, but are still obsessed with kitchenware. They have enormous ranges that, you know, design the house and put in these enormous, you know, six burner ranges, buy all the pots, but never know how to use it. And I go in there and, you know, cook them dinner and they love it because I'm using everything. I think it can become a bit of obsession, but you've got to balance it out because if you do have too much stuff in your kitchen, it's almost a bit daunting. You know, you've got cupboards full of things that are falling out, you know, those cupboards full of plastic containers and salad spinners that you can never get away, you know, drawers of things. But, you know, the idea of having a nice organized kitchen where everything has its place and you don't have too much stuff, you know, neat kitchen towels stacked up in a drawer, very organized. Yeah, you know, when the Virgo in me gets like that, but then the busy life of me can go the other way. I think when I look at kitchen utensils and what I want to buy, because I'm fussy, you know, I'm using them all the time and I don't want too much stuff and I see a lot of stuff, is durability. It's got to be practical. You know, design is very important for me. I love things that are beautifully designed and visually appealing, but I don't want design over function. It's got to be functional. So, you know, you're looking at great materials, whether it be, you know, stainless steel, timber, all of those great raw materials, and it has to be natural materials, I think, with kitchenware. That's the most important thing, durability. They've got to be beautiful because I want to use them. As I said, the whole process of food for me is important, from the chopping the parsley on the board to putting the food on a beautiful plate. It's that, yeah, making it a pleasure. For me, it's the classics that in a kitchen that have stood the test of time. You know, the Storbl and Creuset for great cast iron pots. You know, even, you know, for my kitchen, I have a basic set of Pilivu white china plates for serving dishes, and they're basics and they're classics. And then I add everything else to them. Durilex for glasses, you know. They're cheap, well-priced, and they're the best glasses. And you have stacks of them. You don't need anything else. For my chef's knife, I have a David Mallow knife with a lovely bone handle, and a big chopping board. The most important thing, I love really wonderful wooden chopping boards. So I've got a great Italia chopping board. I've got a great David Mallow one, and they're really important. I'm living in a rented house at the moment, and it's actually not a bad kitchen, but I'm sort of thinking about what I want with my own kitchen. For me, an island is really important because I don't like facing the wall when I'm cooking. Food's a very social thing, and I like the idea of working on an island. So my dream kitchen would have an island with a sink in it and a bin under the bench so I can wash vegetables and do all of that. My dream kitchen would have two dishwashers because, you know, with a family of five, it doesn't take many more people to have a full dishwasher, and I like to be able to, you know, clean up and get out of there. Big double-sided fridge and a freestanding stove, like a range I like. I think the wall ovens, I've had wall ovens before, which are great and they're very precise, but I like the feel of working on a range. It feels like maybe it's working in professional kitchens, but a freestanding range is great.
That was Taya Erdal with Australian chef Bill Granger, and we'll be dropping by the kitchens of three more chefs throughout the show. Mention jelly, and most people will probably get flashbacks to 1970s and 80s birthday parties or childhood sickbeds. Sophisticated jelly, part food, part design, and part architecture, seems like rather a radical new food frontier, but it's actually rooted in history. Our reporter, Amanda Brown, went to the kitchen and workshop of Bompas and Parr, Britain's finest jellymongers, to find out more.
Sam Bompas and Harry Parr don't do things by half. When they hold a culinary event, they often commission relevant music, like this gloriously globulous jelly song.
I'm Harry Parr, and I'm founder of Bompas and Parr, along with Sam. Well, I trained for quite a while to be an architect, and I threw it all in to get on with making jelly. Actually, one of the last projects I was doing when I was at the Bartlett studying architecture was to invite a load of architects to design jelly moulds, and we had so many amazing entries from the likes of Norman Foster and Richard Rogers and people like that, that it just seemed natural to continue to make jelly and to discover what could be done with food and architecture.
Directly next to the kitchens of Bompas and Parr is a room to delight any CDT or craftwork teacher.
Loads of tools, that's very crucial. Harry's very happy because we've got like all these high-tech tools in here. Every time we like have a new project and he can invest in a new tool, he's very happy.
Anne Charlotte Omidal is a graphic designer at the Jellymongers. She showed me how to make a jelly mould of the Brighton Pavilion.
Pull it back, pull up the mould, and then turn the vacuum on. There you go.
Oh, it's perfect. It just shrinks straight over the mould.
Yeah, it's quite nice. I quite like watching that. It's just like... whoop.
Sam Bompas is a man deeply engaged with his craft. His knowledge and love of jelly goes far beyond the easy mix cubes that most are familiar with.
You know, once upon a time, in the Regency period, jelly was a very, very fine, exalted dessert, and we've been trying to restore it up onto its, put it back on its pedestal. It's a dessert that delights. It's you know, really quite magical. Not too many other dishes have the same sort of allure and wobble and charm. And you can also get a lot of great flavours into it. Jellies can be very adult in terms of flavours. Last week I made a brilliant Negroni jelly. It's my favourite cocktail, so you know, it makes a fine jelly as well, but one you have to be quite careful of, as it's rather potent.
Sam and Harry have taken the basics of fun desserts and combined it with architecture and science to create food experiences designed to bring people into their fantasy food world.
When we first started working with jelly, we had a huge event and it was a jelly banquet, and we suddenly realised that the jellies were very small and there wasn't really enough for 2,000 people to be looking at. So we had this problem of how to entertain 2,000 people. And then we started realising that it was more and more the space around the food that actually made that taste experience. So we started looking at how we could engage all the senses. So from that moment onwards, the architecture of an event and smell and sound and things like that became very important, and the food was an element in it, but everything else actually really enhanced the eating experience. So it kept food on its, in its rightful small scale rather than being something that had to be made on a massive scale, which is kind of inappropriate.
Really, it was just really, really enjoying jellies and food and wanting to give people, you know, intriguing, enchanting food experiences. So things that made them look at what's on the end of their fork again in a new way. And really what we try and do is bring all sorts of different and disparate knowledges together to make that happen. So if you start sort of cross-pollinating disciplines, then you get some really crazy results. It's also by necessity as well. When we started out, we wanted to run a jelly company. It was our great ambition. And right here behind me, we've got a couple of these beautiful antique copper moulds, which look exquisite. The problem is, because they look so gorgeous, you know, loads of collectors buy them up at extortionate prices, and we couldn't afford any of them ourselves. They go for about sort of 400 quid or so. So this is when Harry turned to his architectural training and started working out that he could actually design and make his own moulds, you know, because jelly's effectively figurative. And now we've got to a stage where we can make our own copper molds through a combination of sort of modern processes like, you know, sort of CAD design and 3D printing. But then the final stages, which is electroforming, are actually how a lot of the very best Victorian copper moulds would be made as well.
From making a voyage of discovery through sugar crystals by boat across the roof of Selfridges to promote a brand of sweetener, to their current plans to create a new extreme sport by offering a rope climb through a chocolate fountain, Bompas and Parr think big.
Olivia Bennett, jellymonger, making all the jelly for events. We are in a warehouse in Wandsworth and we have 220 litre big blue barrels which are filled with water. Then we mix 26 tubs of chocolate with alginate and blend it madly for 20 minutes, or rather a big burly guy blends it, and we've enlisted the help of some Russian very handy men that can literally push the barrels on their own across the warehouse floor, so we don't have to.
But all the organised food mayhem is built on a solid understanding of the history of jelly.
There are a lot of savoury jellies. Effectively, I think all the first jellies in history would have been savoury as well. We keep on trying to track it down. Apparently, jellies predated Christ. I think apparently the Egyptians were jelly fans. But all the way through history, you had English monarchs coming back from the Crusades and diverting through Italy so they could pick up some bags for jelly, because they needed very fine Italian cloths to get the perfect clear jelly. Yeah, in England, everyone's so, so rude about our food. And it's one of the things that the English really did rather better than everyone else, that and roasting. And the jellying was something that we're so good at that apparently French chefs would sneak across the channel to pick up our ingenious and intricately designed jelly moulds, some of which from the last two centuries are incredibly involved.
It's very nice to hear that it's the other way around for once. We're not stealing food ideas from the French, isn't it?
I think apart from jelly and roasting, everything else it goes the other way. So that's why we really need to be proud of the jelly.
That was Amanda Brown with Bompas and Parr, the London-based jellymongers. Time for a short break now, but stay tuned and get some flowers in your hair. We're off to San Francisco next.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in, and it's covered everything from Moose moving into Anchorage to Jan Gehl's plans to Copenhagenize the world one bike lane at a time.
Density is something about plonking down towers, and if you have enough towers, you have a city.
Join us as we meet the people planning a better urban future and the odd lumbering shaggy beast too. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, time to head to America's West Coast, to one of my favourite cities, where food is taken very seriously indeed. It's almost impossible to eat badly in San Francisco, and a local temple of good taste is Tartine in the Mission District. Tartine's pastry chef is Elizabeth Pruitt, and the bread is made by her husband, Chad Robertson. It's been described as the best bread in the US. Robertson met San Francisco correspondent Alistair G in Bar Tartine, his restaurant a few blocks down from the bakery, to talk about his love of German cooking utensils.
My favourite place in the world to buy things for my kitchen is a place called Manufaktum in Munich. The motto of this place is, "The good things, they still exist." It's a general store that is filled with well-curated, handmade tools of every kind, including kitchen tools, a lot of them that I've never seen anywhere else. And they have a small bake shop called Bread and Butter, Brot and Butter, in the front of the store, where you can get an amazing slice of sourdough rye bread with butter. Not toast, just they don't make toast, they only make slices of bread with butter.
And if a baker thinks that their bread is good, it must be good.
The bread is great. It's made there, sort of bake it right before they open. It's delicious.
What are some of your favorite products there?
I mean, they have pots and pans and knives and, you know, really everything. But on this recent trip, I brought back a small hand bread slicer. It's sort of a wheel blade that's serrated. It's a little stainless steel, brushed stainless steel bread slicer that has suction cups on the feet, so you can secure it to the counter. And then the thing about it that's really exceptional is it's made for slicing dense, really moist German rye breads, which are very hard to slice by hand, thin. So the blade is sort of serrated, and when you slice, you kind of crank the blade in a reverse. It's kind of a reverse rotation that can cut very thin slices of this super dense, moist bread. And it also, the bread that we're sort of known for, tartine, the country loaf, has an extreme contrast between the crust and the crumb. I mean, the crust is thick and really crispy, and the interior is full of large holes and super moist. So it's kind of hard, again, to slice that thin. And this slicer is one of the only implements that can do that.
What do you think their ethos is? I mean, how do they curate all the stuff that they have in the shop?
If you go there, you'll sort of notice they have a citrus juicer, they have a small dough mixer, they have a toaster. But if they have three toasters, it's because each one is the best of a certain type of toaster that you would use. They don't really repeat, they don't have multiples of different things. That, like, there's no redundancy in the whole store. They have the best of every category.
When you visit a kitchen shop, how does it feel to you? Is it like a living museum? Is it like a treasure chamber?
Visiting Manufactum is definitely a little bit like a treasure trove, because they have so many things that I haven't really seen. It's so well curated.
What do you look for in kitchen utensils?
I look for a certain durability and level of craftsmanship in pretty much any kitchen thing that I buy. I don't really like having to use things and upgrade. I'd rather get the best thing and just have it for years and years and years.
Is there any particular company or designer who you think is making really beautiful or well-designed utensils and kitchenware right now?
I'm a big fan of the Breville line of kitchen stuff. I love their blenders, toasters.
Why is Breville better than the other companies making the same products?
Well, for example, like the Breville blender, it can make, it's a high performance blender. I would say, like, it can turn ice into snow, basically. So it can do all of those things. But then at the end of the day, when you're cleaning a blender, there always seems to be gaskets and things that are hard to clean. With Breville, the whole thing just comes right apart.
Who makes the best bread ovens, and why are they so good?
Well, for many years, about 12 years, I used wood-fired ovens, which was based on an Alan Scott design, which was a guy that an Australian gentleman that made ovens here in Northern California for maybe 30 years. He passed away a couple of years ago, and those are my favorite wood-fired ovens. I'm not using a wood-fired oven now. I'm using a gas oven that is, most of the parts are Italian, but it's kind of modified by a friend of mine that has a baking school and consulting firm here in South San Francisco. Looks like a commercial oven. It's stainless steel on the outside, and on the inside, they actually build it in place. It takes 2 weeks to build, and it's filled with refractory bricks and masonry concrete, and so it kind of bakes like a massive masonry wood-fired oven would, but it's more convenient, and so I can focus on the fermentation and stuff like that, as opposed to having to build a fire every day.
How would you describe your perfectly designed kitchen?
For me, a perfectly designed kitchen would be kind of minimal appliances, minimal utensils, a good cook stove, and a couple of good cast iron pots. I don't even really need a dishwasher, because I like to wash dishes by hand. So I think lots of counter space.
Why is that kind of design useful for the kind of cooking that you do?
Working in a bakery and a restaurant every day, it's sort of when, I'm here cooking or making bread or whatever. So when I go home, my wife and I, we're making really simple food.
That was our San Francisco correspondent, Alistair G, with Chad Robinson at Tartine. We're heading to Paris now to a recent event, Paris des Chefs, organised by thrice Michelin-starred Alain Ducasse. It coincides with the Maison et Objet Design trade show, and Paris des Chefs pairs designers with cooks to see what each might learn from the other. Our man in Paris, Alexander Orne, went along to find out.
Since the first edition of Paris des Chefs in 2009, renowned international chefs and promising talents have come together and paired with architects, designers, actors, artists, and photographers. Over 3 days, 24 duos took turns on stage, showcasing in various live performances the bridges emerging between cooking and the different fields of creation. Sponsored by the renowned French chef Alain Ducasse, the event created by Maison et Objet has set out to become the annual rendezvous highlighting the alchemy of food and design. I caught up with Étienne Cochet, the general director of Maison et Objet. What do you want to achieve and what is the idea behind Paris des Chefs?
We thought that a chef that was before that, you know, only in their kitchen, never meeting people except at the end of the plate. But now chef must be just nearby the clients and clients might understand who is the person behind the guy that did cook this idea, the concept. So he's got his own personality. We need to understand. We need to discuss with him. We need to exchange. And this changed these last years. And we were the first with Maison to bring chef and asking them to exchange with designers, architects, all those concerned by arts and craft.
What do you think design and food can bring to each other? What can this do, achieve or inspire, but also instruct?
What the chef did, his own personality, like a designer. How did he present what he was cooking? Why did he choose these products to mix them, to try to mix them? That's why, for us, there's a logic of, it's a kind of a new form of design.
What do you think design can bring to the kitchen?
Design came in the kitchen, really, for last year's, because it's a new way of expressing what you want to present on your plate, what the story behind your plate. So the idea was to bring all these guys on concerned by creation on this different business, but finally telling kind of a same story in the same weekend on the same time.
This year, designer Fernando and Umberto Campana paired with Brazilian chef Alex Atala for the first performance of the event. But how do you approach such an event as a designer?
It's funny because I'm not familiar with cooking. I like to eat good cooking, good food from the chefs. And this was the first time in my life that I'm working with food, you know. Because I think design and food is something today is unique, you know. It's just one thing about creation is the freedom for you to experiment other universes and come back to your own universe more mature, more secure. So it was funny. Meanwhile, I was doing this performance, I start thinking to myself, why not to start making small prototypes of little chairs and sell them in museums, shop or whatever. They are not expensive, you know, and a good opportunity to express myself in this universe. I guess food is the material. Design, you have this decision to design with the food, with the material. It's just the dimension, you know. A chair is big, but you can construct other elements with food, you know. You can design and taste. Because food is alchemy, is the transformation of one material to something very noble, very elegant.
I think inspiration, you don't see it concrete in front of you. It's the magnet wave that passed from him to us, the eye contact. Meanwhile, you were talking to Umberto, I had an inspiration with him. That's an idea. I think this is the best thing. There are no boundaries anymore, I think, between fashion, music, gastronomy and design, literature, movies. I think anything that inspires me.
Stepping out of his kitchen, London-based Swedish chef Mikael Jonsson teamed up with photographer Richard Horton. He told us about their performance.
To come here with a photographer was really the first thing that came on my mind. Both food and photography has been two things that have been very close to me since I was a kid, basically. Personally, I don't think that food is really art. Food for me is more, it's an artisan work, whereas photography of food is an art. We decided very early that we wanted to make almost like a documentary first of an exceptional produce. In our case, we've chosen sika. It's a Japanese deer which is found wild southwest of England, which is an absolutely exceptional produce. So we went down to the southwest and were stalking for deer. Then we've brought the deer with us, or actually almost smuggled a deer into the country, which I'm going to try to skin tomorrow on stage. For me, there's a very important alchemy in that photography can partly transform and immortalize food, perhaps, but perhaps not necessarily in a way that it should be. But it can, for me, transform it into art. And it's also fascinating to see, especially Rich's photographs of food that really transform what you see with your eye, and then you look at the photograph into something completely different. From artists, I do get some inspiration from photography too. Photography was a big hobby of mine when I was a teenager. The whole thing perhaps comes down to my kind of ground zero for interest of food and what I wanted to do as a child. When I was out with my uncle hunting in the forest in Scandinavia, I was also taking pictures, etc. So this tomorrow it's going to perhaps be like a wrap-up of the ground zero of my food interest.
For its fourth edition, Paris des Chefs moved to La Maison de la Mutualité in central Paris. Somehow, an event devoted to food and creation seems rather natural in Paris, but the event is only 4 years old.
When you got the idea, when this first started 4 years ago, and you look at it today, what are you thinking?
How come we didn't do a gastronomy festival in Paris for 50 years? How come? There's no rendezvous in Paris for 50 years. It's a so big pleasure for all these people to come. In the eyes of these chefs from Brazil or the others from all the countries that we saw for 3 days, we understand that there really is a logic to be together. My passion is to bring all the ideas from creation, and a gastronomy festival in Paris seems so evident today.
That was Alexander Owen getting gooey at the recent Paris des Chefs event in the French capital. And from France to Lebanon, we're off to Beirut next. Chef Kamal Mouzawak is a one-man food movement in Lebanon. After starting the Souk al-Tayeb, Beirut's first farmer's market, he's since spearheaded a series of initiatives to support and grow awareness of homegrown, local, seasonal produce and food throughout the country. Our Beirut correspondent, Carol Korm, dropped by Taulet, Kamal's Beirut open kitchen restaurant, to hear about his preferred designs.
It's very difficult to make a choice between different shops around the world, but I would say Duilura in Paris. It's a very, maybe, classical shop, very much loved by American foodies, which makes it very well known too. The store, it's not even a store, it's very much like a professional warehouse, like a showroom, very, very old, with old, very French-style vitrine and old doors painted in like lacquered dark green. And the inside is just like a showroom where there are samples of things where you would order with a salesperson. All salesperson have like old, like whole aprons, you know, like a doctor's outfit, but like in dark blue. So it's very much like a professional neighborhood rather than, you know, like a cute shop or a cute salesperson. Very professional, very efficient, quite loud. It's a different experience. It's not a shop. It's more a showroom than a shop. I love kitchen utensils and I hate kitchen gadgets. So it's very much about like very high quality, top quality objects. Like I like my kitchen to be with the least utensil possible, but with the highest quality. So Duilura has the best pots, in my opinion. You would find their old copper pots, like 3 millimeter thick, the thickest copper pots you can ever find, but with a stainless steel coating from the inside, and not the pewter coating that you have to do very often. So it's like really very, very practical. It's beautiful. It's at the same time a very old pot which has been like using modern techniques of stainless steel. It's like combining both to have the best utensil possible. I think a nice kitchen utensil shop would be to a shop where it would mix many different expressions of kitchen and of food. Like, why should it be only kitchen utensils? Why isn't it kitchen ingredients at the same time? Why isn't it cookbooks too at the same time? So more, I'm going to use a word that I usually never permit myself using, which is like a concept store, you know. Sorry me, but I'm going to use it. So more like about a space that expresses food through different ways, through tools, through equipment, through writings, through images, through ingredients, through fresh produce, through many different things in one place. I just go when I need something, and usually it's like not once a year or once a month, just like once a kitchen. Like when I need to set up a kitchen, a new kitchen of mine, or help someone setting up their kitchen, I go to the shop. It's just like preparing my kitchen, having all utensils and equipment, and later on, I don't find any more need or space to bring more clutter, I would say, to the kitchen. I like my kitchen to be very organized, very clean, and really, really uncluttered. A kitchen is a working space, and for me, a working space must be very organized, very easy to work in, very easy to move in, and like it's, and these must be very much tailor-made spaces, because as of how you live, what do you need, how many people do you cook for a day, do you have a family or not, how much do you entertain or cook at home, so all these different aspects have to, kitchens must really be tailor-made for each one's needs and tastes. I'm very much in a mood to help people design their kitchens. So kitchens are really, usually the way we dress, or, you know, mainly homes, are an extension of ourselves and are a different expression of who we are. And I think the most authentic part of that space is the kitchen itself. And this is the only part where people don't dare expressing themselves yet. Like, they may decorate themselves, arrange or bring a decorator, let's say, to any other part of the house, even to their own bathroom, but nearly never to the kitchen. A kitchen is just a room that someone made, you know, like with just cabinets and few electrical appliances or other, and that's it. It's like we don't even dare to tailor-made it or to fine-tune it to our own life or needs. So this is really something that I would really like to dig in and do more with people.
That was Carol Korm with Chef Kamal Muzawak in Beirut. Time for a short break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be hearing how restaurant design works from a man at the top of his game, Martin Brudnitsky. Next, stay tuned.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Now, chances are, if you've sat in a new or recently renovated restaurant in London, New York or Miami and marvelled at the interiors, you're looking at the work of designer Martin Brudnitsky. The Swedish designer has a studio in London and New York and is the go-to man for translating the wants and desires of chefs and patrons into elegant, beautiful interiors. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, sat down with him in London to hear how he does it.
So, Martin, I want to ask you a question about taste and whether or not the kind of actual cuisine and flavours of the restaurant that you're designing does influence the design, and whether or not you really collaborate with chefs. I mean, do you meet any of them before you start a design?
Absolutely. I mean, the flavor, the menu, the taste is very important of what I'm trying to sort of create the design for. And working with the chefs or with the client is very, very important to have conversations with them about what do they see. This is their restaurant. They're going to run it. And so it's very important to sit and listen to, you know, listen to their story, listen to what they're trying to achieve. And it's very important. I want to be inspired and get excited from hearing about their excitement about their food. And I think that's sort of where I get inspired. And it's about really trying to understand where they are coming from and then sort of put a story, a sort of interior story around that. And it's basically about a working relationship. It's not about me going away and creating something and then that's what they're going to have. It's something we work on over several workshops together.
And what about some examples of that? I mean, are there any chefs or any particular restaurants that spring to mind that you've really sort of brought to life in physical form, that you know, one of their dishes or a certain memory of a flavour that's really inspired you to do something?
The menu is important because it tells you what the food is and what style, if it's like English or if it's, you know, European or is it Japanese or Chinese, all of that sort of will tell you a story of and give you the framework what interior design needs to be. But what's more important for me is, let's say I'm doing a restaurant for a well-known chef, it's to understand them, it's them, their personality. When I work with Richard Corrigan to create Corrigan up at Grosvenor Street, I mean, Richard is a great guy, and he's really funny, he's quirky, and that sort of influenced the design. So we created something that was, because it was all about game, so we wanted to create sort of a modern hunting lodge. But then it had those quirky little thing like a feather lampshade, and it was a table lamp, and it's a feather lampshade, and it had these two duck's feet, and it was these sort of carved timber screens with a deer in it, and you know, so these sort of small little quirky things that was very much Richard.
And in terms of quirky, I mean, there's a lot of theatre to a restaurant. Do you just let yourself go sometimes and, you know, really just indulge in something that is quite wild?
Absolutely. I mean, if you can do something wild, it's great. Usually clients are very careful with that. But theatre, for me, comes actually through where you put the bar. You put the bar in the centre because that's the theatre. Or you put the kitchen in the centre of the room, or the kitchen is in a location where people can see it, because that today is the theatre. It's all about provenance, that people can see how food is being made or how the drinks are being made. The whole sort of concept of fine dining, you have a room with tables and there you sit and eat and it's quiet. That doesn't exist anymore, because a day dining is about a social experience, social interaction, and sort of see people around you, see food, see waiters, see the bar. It's all about that sort of happening, what's going on, the buzz. And as you know, if you go out for dinner and you walk into a restaurant and you walk into this buzz, and you just know I'm in the right place. And that's what we want today.
And talking of buzz, I want to compliment you on your extension to Jay Shiki, which is one of my favourite little spots. The new Oyster Bar there was not so new anymore, but it's wonderful. And I wondered, you know, do you really love that sort of twinkly, very sort of quite classic genre? And is that something that you really specialise in?
Well, thank you first for the compliment. And it's sort of, I specialise in that sort of difficult question. It's more that the product required it to look like that. If we would have done something very minimalist in that space, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have complement, you know, Chic is the restaurant, and I need to sit well with it. So it just happened that the projects I've been approached for are of that style. It probably comes to, I mean, it all started with Scott's that I did, which is sort of an abstraction of a 1940s interior. And since then, I think perhaps a little bit like actors get typecast. It's sort of, I've been a little bit typecast, and people come with those sort of products to me. But as well, I mean, we have done some very sort of contemporary, very sort of modern designs as well. But usually my personal view is, I think a restaurant is all about atmosphere. An atmosphere you get through materials. And the darker a restaurant is, the better, in my view.
And in terms of that, as you say, the sort of abstracted 40s, is it about kind of creating a modern environment, but actually sort of, you know, it's almost masked by this kind of wonderful overlay of classic materials?
That's correct. That's sort of what it's about. It's about creating, because as I said before, the layout of a restaurant, the way we lay a restaurant out today, is very different from how it was done like 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's all about the sense of theatre. It's all about a bar in the centre or a kitchen in the centre of the space. And then you overlay that with finishes. And that's then I overlay that with quite classical finishes to give it that sort of sense of provenance and history.
That was Sophie Grove with Martin Brudnitsky. And in honour of Martin's Swedish heritage, here's a song by another wonderful Swede. Though we hope there's none of this lurking under the tables in Martin's bars and restaurants, this is Chewing Gum by Annie. That was Chewing Gum by Annie. And sticking to a Swedish theme, albeit back in London, it's time to drop by our fourth and final chef. It's the turn now of Mikael Jonsson, whose new Chiswick dining station, Hedone, has been quietly taking the London food world by storm.
What is your favourite place in the world to buy things for your kitchen?
I think that has to be La Boutique du Chef in Cannes, southern France. It's quite small, professional shop where also foodies go, and it's extremely well equipped, and you can basically find anything there. If they don't have it in stock, then they will get it for you.
What are the things you love there, the things you find?
Well, it's more like perhaps getting things that you don't really need, because when you walk in there, you end up buying things that you really don't need, but you think are good to have, and then maybe years after it turns out that you actually never used them. The owner who runs it is there all the time. His wife is sometimes there, but it's a small family business, and he's extremely knowledgeable about all kitchen equipment and what to use to make different things, etc., etc. And it's a fun place to go to and talk about things. He's got also very opinionated ideas on restaurants, on the Riviera, etc., and he's a fun guy.
What pleasure do you get from kitchenware shops? Can you describe the experience of spending time in one?
Well, I suppose the pleasure is wandering around and looking at all these perhaps unnecessary things that you still want to have, because you want to have it all. Perhaps I'm collecting these things. Maybe I'm a collector, and that's why I like it so much. It's very easy to spend the time. The time just flies by.
Is it like a living museum or a treasure hunt?
Well, probably more like an unnecessary addiction, going to these places and really buying things you don't really need. Even if there's something you need, you search for, you always end up getting other things at the same time. But it's great fun. It's great fun to walk around and see all those things that are on the shelves. This shop that I'm talking about is a bit of a mess because it's not very well organized and things are a bit here and there. Everything is there, but you have to search for it.
Is there a company, designer, you think is making beautifully designed cooking utensils? What are they doing that is so unique, valued by you as an expert?
I'm not really into design of kitchen gadgets. That's never really been anything that I've been interested in. So I don't really know that. I look more for how useful it is. And even if I don't acquire it, it's more usefulness that I'm looking for.
Are you like a child discovering new toys, new gadgets, or is it really an expert view that is coming into these shops?
No, it is probably a child looking for toys that also may be fun for 10 minutes and then you want another toy.
How would you describe your perfectly designed kitchen? What works best for you, and how would you design your dream kitchen?
I hope I knew what the perfect kitchen was. When I designed the kitchen for my restaurant, I thought I had found the perfect kitchen, but after a couple of months, I realized that it wasn't, and there were other things that I needed, and I suppose I will never really know what my perfect kitchen will be like.
What works best for you?
Well, like the way it is in the restaurant, works quite well in terms of design. We have a quite small but very efficient kitchen, and we're using pretty much state-of-the-art equipment. We don't have any gas, we have induction hobs, and we have a high-tech steam oven, etc. And it's fun to have all these toys to play with at your disposal.
Do you have an idea yet of your dream kitchen? If you say after 2 months this one is not exactly as you wanted it?
No, absolutely not. I don't think I will. I mean, yeah, I have kind of a vague vision, but I know that I will always discover things that I will want. So I don't think the dream is a bit blur, I think, for me.
That was Mikael Jonsson, chef of Hedenay in Chiswick, West London. If you haven't been there, then you really must book now. It's out of this world. And we're out of time for this week's show. Next week, we're dipping into the world of fashion, dropping in on menswear retailers to hear what they made of the recent collections in Milan and Paris, rating the fashion show invitation designs with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, and we'll be sitting down with another Richard, this one from the architecture world, Richard Rogers. This week's edition of Section D was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.